from WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The spirit of innovation has been the spine of the American dream and the engine of the American economy since before Thomas Edison illuminated the whole world with his light bulb. But according to a new report issued by the National Academies, the foundation of the great American idea factory is beginning to erode. We're going to spend the next hour with Charles Vest, the former president of MIT and co-author of that report, talking about the future of American innovation, a future which one of his co-authors described this way. The U.S. is like a frog that is slowly boiling in water. It doesn't jump out because it doesn't notice it's about to die. China educated 600,000 engineers last year, while America produced 70,000. And Bell Labs, last century's hothouse of innovation, home of fiber optics, the cell phone microphone, and C++ programming language, has been flattened. This hour on Point, we're talking about the unsure future of American innovation. Joining us now from Nashville, Tennessee, is U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee. He requested, along with Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico, that the National Academies assess America's ability to compete and prosper in the 21st century. Senator Alexander, thanks for joining us on Point.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Let me ask you, first of all, what concerned you so to push for creation of this report?
Well, the immediate concern was I was sitting on the budget committee and I saw how we're going to have to be clamping down on federal spending over the next 10 years, and I was afraid we would squash the investments in science and technology that we need to keep good-paying jobs. And the second is the thing that I think most Americans feel. I mean, we worry now about how are we going to keep our good-paying jobs. Are they going to go to China or India? 20 years ago, a lot of our low-paying jobs were leaving. That was all right because most people got better-paying jobs. But now the research jobs, the jobs in the chemical industry, they're going to India and China. That's a real problem.
Well, what do you think is at stake in the future of American innovation?
What's at stake is our standard of living. I mean, we've been very fortunate. I mean, we produce about 30% of all the money in the world in the United States this year for about 5% of the people. And we've had a whole series of things that have made that possible, but most agree that the single thing that has made the most difference is brain power. We've got more people going to college. We've got the best colleges and universities, the most research laboratories. The federal government spends billions of dollars on research and helping people go to college. Up until recently, at least, we've had the best K-12 system, and all of that has given us, more than anything else, our high standard of living, and other countries are catching on to that.
Let me ask you, we're going to go through parts of the report, we hope fairly extensively, over the next hour, but what's your headline out of the findings?
Well, my headline is that we should be worried, but that we can do something about it. And our focus should be very, very narrow. I mean, basically, Senator Bingaman and I walked down the street in Washington to do something very logical, which was to ask the wisest people in our country, the National Academies of Sciences and Engineering and Medicine, exactly what do we need to do to keep our edge in science and technology so we can keep our good jobs. And they told us 20 things to do. Well, my headline is, we ought to do them. And my hope is that the Senate and the House and that the President in his State of the Union address will make this the subject of the State of the Union address and the focus of his next 3 years.
Let me ask you a question on an incident which in some ways might be an example of part of what's at stake. It was reported this weekend that two government biologists, geneticists, working for the National Cancer Center in Maryland, heavily recruited by Stanford to continue stem cell cancer research there, have decided instead to go to Singapore. They're working on ways to see if their earlier discoveries can be used to develop drugs to block cell mutations that might turn into cancers. They're leaving because they'll face fewer restrictions on stem cell research in Singapore than they will here. If they make any discoveries, they'll be patented in Singapore and they'll be first used in Singapore. Are we presently discouraging American innovation in stem cell research? Is the Bush administration?
Well, the answer is yes to that, but that's a reasonable argument. I mean, there are ethical concerns on both sides, and I happen to be on the side of encouraging stem cell research, but I see the other side. What we're talking about in the Academy report really doesn't get to those sorts of political and ethical decisions. We simply have, for a variety of reasons, China and India and Ireland and many other countries in the world looking at the United States and saying, look, our brains work as well as they do. Let's keep our smartest people home. So So they're creating more engineers. China is spending $1 billion to recruit Chinese scientists from our universities, such as at Princeton University, to come back to Beijing or to Shanghai and build up their universities. So it's like going from the Sandlot to the NBA Finals. We're playing in a much tougher league, and we're going to have to get on the stick and do these 20 things that Chuck Vest will be talking with you about, that the academies recommend we do. Otherwise, our standard of living will slowly erode, and we'll be like that frog who didn't know what boiled him.
We don't want to get bogged down this hour in the ethical debate over stem cell research, but let me ask you a process question that comes out of this debate. Stem cell researchers and others listening might be saying to themselves right now, if we can't get the stem cell question ironed out from the research point of view, is there hope for the bigger picture of allowing Americans to innovate beyond stem cells?
Well, of course there is. I mean, stem cell research is very important research. But and there's nothing in the United States to keep it from going forward except how federal money can be used. At places like the University of California and Stanford, or in Massachusetts at Harvard and other places, state dollars are being used. There's no ban on stem cell research. But all I'm saying is that's a small part of what we're talking about. And we don't even have to resolve that ethical dispute to realize that we're going to have to increase by 10% our funding of basic physical sciences research, that we're going to have to dramatically increase the number and the competence of math and science teachers, that we need to revise our laws and make it easier for outstanding foreign scientists to work here at our universities and our laboratories, because for the last 60 years, they've been here helping create a better standard of living for us. So we can do all these things. There are really no bipartisan obstacles to it. The cost is about $10 billion. And to put it in lay terms, we walk down the street and ask the wisest people in the country, what do we need to do to keep our good-paying jobs? They gave us a list of 20 things. We ought to do it.
And now we're going to talk about the list of 20 and what the report found with Charles Vest. Senator Alexander, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for paying attention to this. It's very important.
Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee, who joined us from Nashville. Now joining us is Chuck Vest, former president of MIT, who sat on the National Academy panel. Mr. Vest, hello, and thank you very much for coming into the studio.
Bob, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to express my gratitude, and I know it's shared by 20 other members of the Committee on Prospering the 21st Century, the National Academies, to Senators Alexander and Bingaman for their leadership on this issue.
All right, we want to go through some of the findings in the report. First of all, I'll read a couple of things and get you to comment on them. A report finding, the scientific and technical building blocks of our economic leadership are eroding. What do you mean?
The issue, Bob, is complacency. We are still king of the hill in science and technology. We are still the most innovative society in the world. But things are pointing downhill fast. This is a highly competitive, globalized world. As you know, Tom Friedman's caught the public attention with explaining the death of distance, that it no longer matters in many businesses, whether you're in Bangalore or Bethesda, Maryland. This is a world in which Intel, we're told by its chairman, Craig Barrett, one of the members of our committee, produces 90% of its products that at any moment did not exist 12 months previous. This is a fast-paced world. And as we look around, we see increasing failures in our K-12 science and mathematics teaching. We have some ideas how to deal with that. We all know the labor costs for what you would pay one chemist or one engineer in the United States. A company can hire 5 chemists in China or 11 engineers in India. We have now become a net importer of high technology products. And we looked, Senator Alexander mentioned the chemical industry. Chemical companies are closing 70 facilities in the U.S. last year, and have tagged 40 more for shutdown. Of 120 chemical plants being built around the world at major prices of $1 billion or better, one is in the United States, 50 are in China. So what we are concerned about is that we have become too complacent about where we stand, and that we have to get our act together and pay attention to the fundamentals so that our children and grandchildren will have the jobs of tomorrow.
Report finding, quote, although many people assume that the U.S. will always be a world leader in science and technology, this may not continue to be the case in so much as great minds and ideas exist throughout the world. But, Professor, great minds have always existed elsewhere. What's different about this moment in history for the U.S.?
What's different, Bob, is that China, India, Singapore, Western Europe, emerging Europe, Scandinavia, all around the world, people are realizing that the future belongs to those who build their industry on brain power, who innovate, who compete, who are smart and fast. They've looked at the United States. They know what our competitive advantage is. It's a strong science and technology base coupled with free markets built on a base of democracy. And they're looking at what we have been doing for the last 40 years and saying, by golly, we can not only do that, we can invest heavily and do it better. So if you look at the sheer numbers, China, India, Singapore, and even Western Europe are educating a much larger percentage of their students in science, math, and engineering, and doing it well.
We're talking with Charles Vest, former president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, about the unsure future of American innovation. You can join the conversation. Do you have doubts about the state of American inventing? Inventors, are you developing new technologies that are going to shape the future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Stay with us. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Charles Vest, former president of MIT, about the unsure future of American innovation. You can join the conversation. How do you see the future of American innovation? Is the U.S. falling behind the big ideas of the Chinese and the Indians, or do you put your faith in the hands of American corporations and universities? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Whatever can be said about the competitiveness of American research and experimentation, there is a chorus of advertisements among American companies that claim innovation is their bedrock. We're going to hear some of those advertisements now from Hewlett-Packard, General Electric, and the Ford Motor Company.
N is for nanotechnology, the study of things less than 1/1000th the width of a human hair. These are nature's building blocks, and they can be used to build some amazing things, like a cell phone so small an ant could use it, or a tiny computer that can hold every book ever written, or maybe some things we haven't even thought of yet. N is for nanotechnology, and it's brought to you by HP, a leader in this science of almost limitless possibilities.
I'm Jeff Immelt, CEO of GE, and welcome to Eco Imagination.
Whether capturing the power of the wind or the sun, or discovering cleaner and more efficient solutions to generate electricity, GE Energy is using Eco Imagination to find ways to power our world.
If you look at the Ford Motor Company, innovation has driven everything we've done, starting with the Model T and the assembly line. What we've done is recommitted ourselves to American innovation, dramatically ramping up our commitment to hybrids. We'll have about the same number of vehicles that'll be ethanol capable. Innovation will be the compass that guides this company going forward.
A few television ads for the Ford Motor Company, General Electric, and Hewlett-Packard are all suggesting that innovation is alive and well in the American corporation. Charles Vest, if it's not all well, why are we being told this constantly?
Innovation, Bob, is alive and well in U.S. and U.S.-based companies, but what I think you are hearing is corporate America's recognition that staying strong in innovation is what the future is all about. What with Senator Alexander and Bingaman and others' leadership, we are attempting to do is to call attention to the fact that this is not a birthright. It has to be continually earned, and the federal government needs to be aware of the importance of investing in innovation if our kids are going to have the right skills to participate in and to create the new jobs of the future.
Let me read you another part of the National Academy report and get you to comment on it. We fear the abruptness with which a lead in science and technology can be lost, and we fear the difficulty of recovering a lead if it can be regained at all.
It's one thing to climb the hill, it's another to fall off it and then start your way back up. You know, I just heard Senator Alexander mention Singapore. I just came back from Singapore and Tokyo earlier this year. I was in Shanghai. While I was in Singapore, I saw a former MIT faculty member, terrific young superstar in nanotechnology who has gone to Singapore. The vice president for research, the Nanyang Technological University there, is a former colleague of mine at the University of Michigan. Biopolis, where this Stanford researcher is going to work, is really something to behold. And what we're facing is places like that that are focusing laser beam-like on one or two areas, whereas the U.S. has to compete to innovate broadly across the whole spectrum of industries. So the sky has not fallen. We just want to be sure that we understand that there are others out there whose numbers are increasing dramatically. The investments are going up. They're hungry. They're after our business.
Let's bring another voice to the conversation, James West, who spent over 40 years as a researcher at Bell Labs, where he developed electronics technology that's now used in 90% of microphones used in cell phones and recording devices. James West holds more than 50 domestic and 200 foreign patents and is now a research professor at Johns Hopkins University. James West, hello, and thank you very much for appearing on Point.
Thank you.
Take us back, if you would. What was it like at Bell Labs back in the 60s and 70s? Give us a tour of the place.
Well, it was one of the greatest institutions that ever existed in terms of research in science, engineering, and technology. One thing that that I like to say about Bell Labs that perhaps differed from most other research institutions is that your door was always open. It did not matter the discipline that someone might come from that knocked on your door. You were obligated to teach that person whatever he or she needed to know about your particular technology.
So it wasn't only an idea factory; it was a factory of education too.
It was definitely a factory of education. Most modern contributions in science, engineering, and technology are no longer done by one person. I mean, we're away from the Edison and the Faraday age, where the combination of technologies is where the richness in innovation lie today.
What's it like at Bell Labs now? I know you're not there anymore, but it's not the case today, as I understand it. Why?
Well, it's not the case because the funds that are necessary to support a laboratory of the size of Bell Labs is enormous. Research is not cheap in both manpower and finances. And the misfortune of the communications industry in this country, which is another major problem that that we face, the companies that made products for communications are no longer in as much demand as they have been in the past.
Let me ask you, can you work today the way you and other scientists worked back then? And if not, why not?
Well, we can work today as we did back then, but being at a university and where most of the major research is being done in this country, there's a tremendous problem of funding. I was very happy to hear the legislators mention earlier that they were appealing to the government to release funds for research. We spend so much time writing proposals for the research that we want to do only to get very good scores but no money. And of course, in today's university, without the money, the research doesn't happen.
James West and Charles Vest stay with us. We're going to take a few phone calls now, bring a few on-point listeners into the discussion. You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. David is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. David, you're on point.
Hi. Very interesting discussion. My question is this. With the emphasis in this country primarily on graduate education, we're putting a lot of money into high-end research at the graduate and postgraduate level, but our competitors, say the Asian Tigers and a lot of these countries that have observed what we do, are putting a lot of their money into primary education. Now, they don't have the graduate school system, but they do have really good primary, and that's where they're kicking our tails, I think. And a lot of these studies show that U.S. Primary education, K through 12, is where we're falling behind in math and science. And my question is, do we have an inverted pyramid here, where essentially our foundation is kind of weak? We have great graduate schools, which the rest of the world chooses to use, and our own students are falling way behind, and so our foundation is weakening. That's my question.
Charles Vest, former MIT president, question to you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for saying that. Our report begins with the investment in 10,000 teachers to educate 10 million minds in K through 12 science and math education.
How do you do that?
This is the absolute bedrock, and what we have proposed is that the federal government should annually provide scholarships, four-year scholarships, for 10,000 science and math teachers to be educated in our universities in the disciplines they will teach, and to do so in programs where in 4 years they can get a disciplinary degree in math, physics, chemistry, whatever it is, and also be certified teachers. Two-thirds of our kids are taught science and math by teachers who have no certification or major in the subjects they teach. We can do something about this.
Do you think there's the political will there to do something about that?
I believe the political will is gathering. We've heard strong voices both sides of the aisle in the Senate saying it's time to stop talking and do something about this. We need to get the Congress. We need to get the administration. For the first time in several years, I'm actually optimistic. I know that Secretary Spellings is excited about our report. We really have to do it now.
The report recommends decisive action now for enhancing math and science education in grade school and high school. This is not, though, I take it, to turn every kid into the next Edison. It's to stimulate those few who might make it?
It needs to attack two parts of the spectrum, Bob. Number one, we do absolutely need to get a greater number of our U.S. citizen young men and women into the leading edge of these fields. But we also have to improve broadly the science, math, technology, education of our young people so that they can perform jobs at all kinds of level. They need to be knowledgeable. They need to have some quantitative skills.
Okay, David, thank you very much for your phone call. Let's take another, 1-800-423-8255. Urban is calling from Chepachet, Rhode Island. Urban, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, you're on point.
Thanks for taking my call. I guess my comment has to do with basically a concern that we can do all the educating we want and can enroll all the students we want in engineering, but if there aren't going to be engineering jobs in the United States for them, we're actually doing them a disservice. And I think your guest sort of hit on this earlier in their comments. You know, basically, if a corporation can get 5 or 11 engineers in the developing world for the price of one here in the U.S., they're going to export those jobs. So, you know, we have a free trade globalization system which basically encourages corporations to move those high-cost jobs overseas. So unless we respond to that issue, we're really educating people for nothing.
James West, have you seen people, have you seen jobs go overseas in your work in R&D and in thinking for the future of America, so to speak, out there?
The answer is, of course. The world is in a state of flux in many, many areas, including science and technology. But there is one advantage that this country has that it's not taking full advantage of, and that's the diversity of its population. both in terms of race and sex. And it has been shown by many companies in this country that a diverse workforce generates a better product or generates better research. And I think it is this advantage that the U.S. has over China and India and other countries that have more or less a monolithic society. I do not fear that we will over-educate in science, engineering, and technology. One good model is Ireland, who Ireland has the second highest per capita income in the European Common Market. And the reason for that is that they made the kind of investment in education at the K-12 level, and also allowing all qualified people to go on to college virtually free. This is the plan that I'm hearing that I'm very optimistic about in this country, mainly because it's a proven technique for improving the quality of life for everyone.
Charles Vest.
I only want to add to those very good words of James West the fact that the recommendations of this committee are aimed at bringing the number of U.S. citizen young men and women majoring in science and engineering up close to international benchmarks. They are not overshooting the mark at all. And then, of course, we have to pay a lot of attention to the very top end, those who will go on to get PhDs in these important fields. And we believe very strongly that we need to mount every year 5,000 new graduate fellowships that will be portable. That is, the student will go to whatever graduate school he or she believes serves her best purpose. So the key point is that we cannot fall into the trap of looking at the immediate job situation. The point is, this is the knowledge age. It's the age of innovation. We got to be out at the leading edge because we cannot beat other countries based on low wages, geographic location, or natural resources. It's brain power.
Quick call before the break. Suzanne is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Suzanne.
Yeah, hello. Wonderful subject matter. We've got an awful lot of issues in our minds on this end in the real world out here in the industrial sort of waterfront of Gloucester, where we're very much concerned how the higher-end academic institutions of research and teaching are failing. Failing now have failed in a number of ways for many years. A case in point here in the Northeast Fisheries, there is no standing research at all, whether from MIT, Woods, or anybody else, on the issue, for instance, of vessel economics. You cannot discuss ocean-saving ocean ecology without discussing how much it costs you to go out fishing if you cannot all go out fishing. It's like running a trucking business in the lower 48, not knowing what your truck is burning. There's no sensibility on this thing. We design boats here for 50 years. We've been watching things for many years declining. Norway can casually take away from a major American shipbuilding outfit a cruise ship design. There's 4 million people in Norway can take away a major contract out of this country. A program in the south of building 3 cruise ships for American use, coastal use, we see went belly up between incompetence, graft, and absenteeism on an intellectual basis. Things are tragically already going on right now. The future is here now, gentlemen.
Suzanne, before the break, we want Charles Vest to weigh in here on your concerns.
As James pointed out earlier, the funding for research in U.S. universities in physical sciences, engineering, mathematics, and computer science has been absolutely flat since the 70s. We cannot expect our universities to do a better job to delve into these very challenging areas, such as the oceans, in more depth and with more people power if we don't get those research budgets up. So this we call sowing the seeds for the future. I agree with you very much. The future is now. And just as I said, Singapore is focusing. You've pointed out Norway's focusing. We've just got to be better and faster and get out ahead.
James West, I know we're going to let you go as we go to the break, but I want to ask you one more quick question. We've got about a minute. Are you optimistic about the future of American ideas?
It's a very good question. I'm optimistic about the future of American ideas, provided we do something to nurture them. If we continue in the direction that we've been going for the past 15, 20 years, I'm not optimistic. I'm pessimistic about us holding our position in the world. However, the proper investment into, as it's been put, into brain power, which we have an awful lot of, untapped is the way to our future, is to tap into this brain power, to utilize it in ways that will benefit everyone in the world, as we have done to this point.
James West, keep at it, researching at Johns Hopkins University. And thanks, Charles Vest. Stay with us. You're listening to On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Charles Vest, former president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, about what some see as the wobbly future of the American innovation economy. You can join the conversation. Where do you see big, exciting, revolutionary American ideas? Do you see them at all? We're at 1-800-423 Talk. That's 1-800-423-8255. President Vest, the report Rising Above the Gathering Storm, Energizing and Employing America for a Brighter Economic Future. One of the recommendations is a more hospitable environment for scientific research and training at the college and the graduate levels. What do you want to do, and what's not happening there now?
Well, there are two areas of being hospitable. One is working in our colleges and universities to do a better job, particularly in the education the first year of our students in science and engineering. But the big issue of hospitality, in my view, is our hospitality to international students and scholars and research workers. In what I think every objective observer views as unfortunate overreactions after the terrible attacks of 9/11, we have created a complex visa review system. We are in the process of expanding export control laws in very unfortunate directions that have created the image out there around the world, and I can tell you this firsthand, that we are not a welcoming place to the world's best and brightest anymore. This is one of the areas I feel most strongly about. We need to continue to be the magnet for the world's best and brightest. This has made our industries great. It's made our universities great. Just look at the Nobel laureates that MIT is so proud of. A little over half are American, but others come from Japan, Germany, Italy. This is what has made America great. We've got to keep this brain power coming here. And once these bright men and women are educated, rather than pushing them back out of the country, as we are currently doing, we need to welcome them with open arms by giving them at least a one-year extension of their visas to look for jobs here in the U.S. And, Bob, this is not just a university issue. I was talking last week with Tom Connolly, who is the Senior Vice President, Chief Technology Officer of DuPont. And he was telling me that the export control regimes, the so-called deemed export of technology when foreign individuals come in contact with it, is becoming a major force pushing U.S. R&D and companies like his overseas and out of this country. We really have to go to work on it, and our report has some very specific recommendations of how we can do that.
Clarify something for me, if you would. We talked about the numbers earlier in the program. 600,000 engineers graduating from higher education in China last year, 350,000 in India, but just 70,000 in the U.S. Are the Chinese and the Indians coming here for school, or are they increasingly getting educated at home?
In the spirit of accuracy, that 600,000 number may be a little bit large, but the point is it's somewhere 400,000-600,000. These are numbers representing students educated in science and engineering in China and India. They are ramping up remarkably fast.
Okay. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call. Emil is dialing from Waltham, Massachusetts. Emil, hi. You're on Point. Oh, we'll get back to Emily in just a couple of minutes. Let's try Andrew from Hastings, New York. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I was curious about the creative side of America keeping its innovative edge and what the thoughts were on making sure that in our passion to move forward on math and science education, the need to also make sure that we're keeping up our creative edge and developing our creative minds on the arts and humanities front. I know from having spent some time in Singapore that something their government is very worried about in education is that they're turning out very strong quantitative thinkers, but folks who really can't innovate because they can't think creatively.
Andrew, you are absolutely correct. And when I said at the top of this program that America is still the most innovative society in the world, that's exactly what I have in mind. If there is a weakness, particularly in the approach I see building in China and India, it is that they have an extremely utilitarian view of higher education. It really is that combination of a strong science and engineering base and the fact that our education weaves it into the arts, the humanities, and the social sciences. MIT is, of course, famous as a leading science and engineering university, but I cannot imagine providing the kind of education that we need for the 21st century without bringing those creative pieces into the puzzle. Now, we are talking here about trying to raise, for example, the number of engineers we graduate to something like 5-6% of the students attending college. So we're not saying everybody's supposed to be a scientist and engineer, but our kids do need a good quantitative base, and we need to leaven all this mix as we do so wonderfully with the arts and humanities. This is a creative edge that we have to build on, but we're forgetting some of the fundamentals in science, engineering, and math.
President Vesta, I'm wondering your take on this. Across America, in elementary and high schools, is teaching to the test, the academic achievement tests that school kids must now take across the board, part of the problem? Are we hemming in the minds of kids, putting the blinders on so that they can see the test question, but maybe not the rest?
This is a conundrum, and in my view, it's a phase. And here I'm expressing, Bob, a personal opinion, not an opinion that necessarily represents the Committee on Prospering 21st Century. I, for one, do believe in testing and accountability. But as we go through the phase of introducing this in a serious way nationally and locally, there is no question that there has been too much teaching to the test. I believe as we get used to it, as we look at longitudinal data following test results over time to see what schools are improving, what schools are not improving, and so forth, that testing on a continual basis is actually a good thing. But if you ask me, are we doing too much teaching the test at the moment, I suspect the answer is yes.
Okay, listeners, I'm going to weave a little circle here, so follow the logic for a minute. How much does big business contribute to the problem of not allowing its workers to innovate or not supporting innovation? Is adherence to the bottom line in big business, the need to make quarterly statements look good to investors, part of the problem?
Short-term pressures on businesses, big and small, but especially big, is clearly part of the problem. In a related activity, the Council on Competitiveness's recent report, Innovate America, which was co-chaired by the CEO of IBM, Sam Palmisano, and the president of Georgia Tech, Wayne Clough, they made a very specific plea to stretch out the time frame on which corporations are responsible for hitting the bottom line. They don't like to do this. They have to live with it. It is a factor. And if I could interject, kind of adding that question to wonderful picture that James West painted earlier about the history of Bell Labs, the good old days, so to speak, where big companies have gotten their innovation has changed. In the 70s, it was the era of the big lab, big corporate labs like Bell. in the 80s when the Japanese showed us that we couldn't compete in the manufacturing sector. The whole R&D activity got overturned. Those labs, by and large, were totally transformed. In the 90s, companies looked around and said, hey, we're not innovating internally enough. So what did they do? They bought up small entrepreneurial startup companies. Now venture capital is getting very risk-averse, and the real question is, as we enter the first part of this new century, where's that innovation coming from? I'll tell you, it's coming from all over the world. It's following the ideas of Henry Chesbrough at Harvard Business School on open innovation. So there's this kind of network building out there, and companies are having a really hard time adjusting to this. So I think the bottom line pressure short term suppresses it. Companies are trying to find their way out of the wilderness.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned business schools, because I'm wondering if Harvard and MIT and Sloan need to do more to challenge the business model that may have businesses across America pinned down to the balance sheet, so that businesses are more forward-thinking. Are the business schools engaged in the same sort of public school exercise, so to speak? Are they teaching to the test of survival in today's business world instead of teaching graduates to innovate?
In the 80s, the business schools picked up on the manufacturing problems. In the 90s, they picked up on the entrepreneurship side, which, for heaven's sakes, continues to be extremely important. But I would challenge the business schools to pay more attention to the overall issue of innovation and also, frankly, sustainability. So I think business schools, engineering schools, science schools need to work together. And we do have to get some of this environment changed, not only the pressures for rapid results to the bottom line, but for heaven's sakes, U.S. industry last year, according to my information, spent more on tort litigation total than they did on R&D.
Well, we should churn out more lawyers then. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. ML is now on the line with us from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, ML.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. This is an extraordinary subject. I would like to share a little perspective, and I would like to make a quick comment and ask your guest a quick query. Coming from an academic background and having educated in India and the premier institutions and having been to premier institutions in the U.S., I was just about to touch on the topic where, which is very, very critical and current, is the number of jobs of very highly educated individuals being lost. I'm talking about not a graduate. I'm talking about PhDs and masters who are losing jobs in this country. And this was a very nice, and just a follow-up of somebody else's who raised this thing. And I had a quick comment, and I would want your guests to think what exactly they think about it. I think the immediate point I would like to see is if there was a massive infusion of funds into an academia to recycle the talent that would otherwise be lost to wilderness. When I say that, there are some extremely brilliant people who are not finding jobs. And to this effect, it is great to think about building a massive pools of talent from K to high school with math and science and engineering emphasis. But the most immediate need is some very, very brilliant people are losing their jobs. So I would like to see, and to some extent at Brandeis, which is where I teach, we actually are trying to tap into those people to build a very, very good informatics department. So I was just wondering, your guests can enlighten and anything on this.
Okay, let's let Charles Vest take that question.
Well, there is no question that jobs are moving around the world and around the country, and at any point in time, you're going to find some very smart people who may be between jobs. One of the things I think we really need to do is to, while I don't like the word, we need to incentivize our companies, our industries, to help in substantial ways with retraining. And one of the things that our committee has recommended is a set of tax credits that will encourage industry to invest in the continuing education of their workforce. Now, that may not get exactly to Emil's point, but we do need to keep people sharp, up to date, and in a position to occupy the jobs that do exist, and that's another piece of the puzzle that has to be put together.
President Fest, I'm wondering, do you think inventors still hold a special place in American lore? Is their creativity today prized the same way we think it was once?
I think, Bob, the issue is that while inventors are still worshipped in certain circles, they are not a contemporary part of the big culture that is so dominated by sports and entertainment and so forth. We've done a lot of work at MIT, working with the Lemelson Foundation and others to try to get that spirit of invention as well as innovation back on the front burner a little bit. We don't do a very good job. But the second part of it is, and James West referred to this very clearly early in the program, so much of the innovation today no longer comes from the lone inventor in the basement. It comes from teams cutting across disciplines who have to work together. So that's another adjustment we're making. If you look at things like work of the Broad Institute in genetic medicine, or just look back at the Human Genome Project, this wasn't done by biologists alone. It involved computer scientists, it involved mathematicians, it involved engineers who know about sophisticated automation. So a lot of the innovations coming from groups as well as the lone individuals who still have those stunning insights.
Let me ask you one more question, if I might. Your sense of, in the big picture, whether there's recognition of this diminishing innovative spirit in America, whether there's recognition that it is a serious national problem.
I do not think there is sufficient recognition, particularly at the level of government. Now, when we talked about the huge numbers in India and China, what I'm really concerned about is not pure numbers. It's that this is at the top of their national agenda. Science and engineering are the things that are recognized as being important to the young people. So it is this whole culture and value system as well as the specifics. But in the meantime, let's get the basics put in place by taking the recommendations, the 20 recommendations of the National Academies Committee, and making them real.
Professor Vest, thank you very much. Former MIT President Charles Vest, continuing professor of mechanical engineering at MIT. Professor Vest, one of the 20 members, committee members, to issue the report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, Energizing and Employing America for a Brighter Economic Future. Professor, hopefully at least 1 hour's worth of discussion today sparks more discussion.
I hope so. Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Bob Oakes, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.